Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 23rd, 2003. Today's session is Planting the Church by Train, presented by Chuck Anderson. Let's listen in.
This session is Planting the Church by Train. In case you wanted something else, you have time to get off before the train leaves the station. My name is Chuck Anderson, otherwise known as Choo Choo Charlie. And some of my credentials, just to tell you what screwball you're sitting with this evening. I have traveled 745,605 miles that I can document by passenger train. And that translates into a little more than 30 miles every single day that I have lived. Or about 45 minutes every day that I have lived on average I've spent on a train. And Shirley and I have traveled in 48 countries, including a 1998 around-the-world trip by train, except for hopping over the two ponds. Been on over 250 different railroads, and I love trains. And I want to tell you four reasons why I really like trains. The first one is that they're fun. The second reason is that I enjoy traveling, and for me, the process of getting from point A to point B is usually more important than getting to the destination. Airplanes are either for people that hate to travel or have to get there fast. Okay? And third, there is more potential in moving goods and people by rail than any other mode of transportation yet invented. Lower fuel consumption, less environmental pollution, using less land than any other form of transportation. A modern freight train, for instance, carries 8 times the capacity per unit of fuel. It's 8 times more efficient than a modern truck. Two parallel sets of railroad tracks carry the same amount of goods and people as 22 lanes of highway. One 18-wheeler wears out the highway at approximately the same rate as 6,000 automobiles. Ponder this too, that no carrier of people anywhere in the world makes a profit. Every single carrier of people is subsidized. And even in the United States, with the enormous federal and state subsidies that go to the airlines have only made a profit 2 of the last 15 years, even with the subsidy. So it's not only 911. But we're getting too serious too quickly in my presentation. We can talk about more of this later, but the topic is planting the church by train. One more aside, what I've just shared and what I will be sharing is part of what I've been working at for 30 years. Once upon a time, I thought it was the beginning of a thesis for an advanced degree in church history. Never finished that. But I told you there were four reasons for my love of trains, and I've only shared three of them. The fourth is the most honest and the best answer. I don't really know. I do know that by age 5, I was fascinated by trains and was soon riding between my hometown of Lindstrom, Minnesota, and Rush City, Minnesota, where my grandmother lived, on a mixed passenger and freight train on the Northern Pacific Railway, and the crew let me ride in the engine from time to time. It's virtually impossible to know who invented the train. We do know for sure that there were horse-drawn cars on a wooden narrow-gauge track in Alsace in a coal mine in 1550, which would be just a few years after Luther died. England, France, and Russia all boast the first successful steam engine, and they all can make a good case for being first. in the 1760s. Take your pick. The first successful steam locomotive running on iron rails was probably in Britain in 1812. And the Stockton and Darlington in 1825 was probably the first railroad to move both freight and passengers. In the United States, the Baltimore and Ohio was first organized in 1827, with passenger service beginning in 1830. But enough speculation. Those of us that are Christians know the answers. The Bible mentions King Uzziah as the inventor of the train. 2 Chronicles chapter 16, verse 50. He made engines in Jerusalem. But some people don't think that engines might be railroad engines. So we'll look a little deeper. And what about this? And the Queen of Sheba came to Jerusalem on a very great train. That's in 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 2. And if you laugh too much, people out there interpret the Bible just like this. But my very favorite text about early trains and model trains in the Bible, Trinity Sunday, we just passed that, Isaiah 6, 1, and his train filled the temple.
The apostles used a Honda. They all went off in one accord.
Very good. And there are lots of references to trains in our hymnals, of course. In Advent, we sing, "Lo, he comes with clouds descending once for a favored sinner slain. Thousand saints attending swell the triumph of his train." Hallelujah. And rather militaristic, we don't sing it so often anymore, but LBW, 183, "The Son of God goes forth to war, a kingly crown to gain. His blood-red banner streams afar. Who follows in his train?" Then the answer comes, "Who best can drink his cup of woe, triumphant over pain, who patient bears his cross below, he follows in his train." But Sarah's going to help us sing the best known train hymn. And we're going to sing all four stanzas of Life's Railway to Heaven. And enjoy
it. Can everybody see it, Bobby? Or?
You'll maybe have to share.
I think there's some right there.
No.
Fake it if you don't know it. It'll come to you. And enjoy the wonderful imagery in here.
Thank you.
Griffith Chapel some night with you Jaspers. Good. Thank you, Sarah. There are many connections between trains and churches, some known, some quite interesting, some even important. There's even a little known connection between the railroad and Augustana College, Rock Island, and St. Olaf College in Northfield. And today I just learned of another for Valparaiso University in Indiana. We're going to talk about four things. And don't worry, the first one is longer, so when that goes longer, you know that the rest of it goes faster. Evangelism first, social ministry second, gifts to churches and the colleges, and then preachers and railroading, which we must get to because that's quite delightful. Probably the first chapel car was Russian. The Russian Orthodox Church operated at least five chapel cars on the Trans-Siberian and Trans-Caspian railroads, bringing the liturgy to the remote places along the lines. And also the last chapel car was Russian, given by the government, interestingly, to the Russian Orthodox Church in the mid-1990s, after the fall of communism. We're going to focus, though, on our United States chapel cars, and there the story begins with Barney Smith, an American Baptist missionary in Minnesota, who began his work during the summers in the late 1880s. He traveled on the Northern Pacific Railway, where some of the officers were very supportive to his efforts to plant the church. At first, he traveled by regularly scheduled passenger train to the places he thought would be ripe for the gospel. He'd head out on Friday or early Saturday and return after a full weekend of preaching. There would be Bible schools, there would be worship meetings, there would be revival meetings, often in a town park or a pasture on a farm. Smith, drawing on his experience, envisioned a church on rails, a specially equipped passenger coach that could be attached to the end of the train, spotted on a siding in any community and remaining there for a time. It would move from location to location as needed. Would this be feasible? Well, among Uncle Boston's friends was Dr. Wayland Hoyt, pastor of First Baptist Church in Minneapolis. He often rode the Northern Pacific Railway with his brother Colgate, a railway executive. Colgate sold on the concept of the railroad car church, a parsonage and chapel combination that could go wherever the tracks were laid. And he established the Chapel Car Syndicate. And you might recognize some of the names of this first group of men that formed the Chapel Car Syndicate: Charles Colby, John Trevor, William Hills, James Colgate. He was the one that had something to do with toothpaste. John D. Rockefeller. And E.J. Barney, who was president of a railroad car building firm. In 1891, the first of what would be a fleet of seven chapel cars came off the assembly line. It was called Evangel, an appropriate name, literally meaning good news. On its first run, Evangel's first stop was in Brainerd, Minnesota, where three meetings were held, and then it continued west in Minnesota, North Dakota, and Montana, with major stops in Fargo and Billings, Montana. On Easter Sunday, 1892, it arrived in Everett, Washington, and celebrated what is thought to be the first baptism in that area, establishing a church that still is there as a vital congregation. The Northern Pacific Railway provided free passage for this car. And between this first chapel car in 1891 and 1915, six other cars were built, given to their names. Emmanuel, glad tidings, goodwill, messenger of peace, herald of hope and grace. And we're going to tell you just a little snippet about each of those cards and what happened. But I think we need to dedicate the chapel car evangel so we could have our pianist return. And we will sing for the dedication of the chapel car, which was actually on May 23rd, 1891, in Cincinnati, Ohio. A special hymn had been commissioned, and you will recognize the tune, I think, very readily. We'll sing both stanzas. Texas and traveled throughout New Mexico and Arizona with major work in Flagstaff and Williams. Then it went north to Sacramento, California and Portland, Oregon, and then continued back to railway workers, especially in Wisconsin, Nebraska, Kansas, and Iowa. Charles Rust was the missionary for the chapel car entitled Glad Tidings. He promoted worship especially for the then 900,000 railroad workers in the United States. This was around 1895. And he offered services at noon and at midnight, and almost any time in between that people would come. And his slogan was, "Come as you are." And he loved it when people would respond, "You have brought the church to me." Goodwill plied West Texas in the late 90s with missionary E.J. Townsend. He offered up to 4 services per day that served as many as 1,000 worshipers per day. Because it was put in the most secure setting in the city, because it was the most precious commodity or thing in the city of Galveston, it's the only, or one of the very few, maybe there were a few, but one of the very few structures that survived the great storm in Galveston in 1900. Messenger of Peace was featured at the centennial of the Louisiana Purchase Celebration in St. Louis, Missouri. It worked hand in hand with the YMCA and made many runs along the remote New River Gorge on the Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad. Amtrak's Cardinal, by the way, still runs through this gorgeous area, and I would nominate that as the most scenic eastern Amtrak ride. Herald of Hope provided ministry to the coal miners in West Virginia. Its work, especially during a strike that turned violent, was very successful, not only in preaching the gospel, but in fostering peace and understanding between labor and management. But it wasn't only the Baptists that promoted the chapel car. In fact, they didn't even have the first chapel car in the United States. The Episcopalians were first. The cathedral car of North Dakota, entitled Church of the Advent, was built a year before the first Baptist car that we just dedicated a few minutes ago. It continued in service for 9 years. And then the Diocese of Northern Michigan had a chapel car, the second of the three Episcopalian cars, and that served the small copper and timber towns along the Duluth, South Shore, and Atlantic Railway, and other smaller lines in northern Wisconsin and Michigan. The third Episcopal chapel car served the Ontemagon community after the devastating 1896 fire. And that fire destroyed the entire town in less than 4 hours. And the chapel car stayed there on the siding for 5 years until they built a permanent church building. And the Roman Catholics also had three chapel cars. St. Anthony built in 1907, St. Peter in 1912, and St. Paul in 1915. St. Anthony served for more than 40 years touring branch lines in Kansas, especially planting Catholic missions all the way actually from Oregon to Florida. And St. Peter served the Mexican population in Kansas, and St. Paul spent most of its time in Louisiana. The last American Baptist car was Grace, dating from 1915, and it was of steel construction, 85.5 feet long and 10 feet 8 inches wide. Dedicated in Los Angeles, it served California and Utah, and spent a lot of time, interesting, in Las Vegas, Nevada. In 1946, it was moved to the Green Lake American Baptist Assembly Camp at Green Lake, Wisconsin. It has been beautifully restored and is on location in the Bible Camp off Highway 23, just in case you're in the area and might want to stop for a visit. The car is locked, but there's an information key at the registration desk. Our family has been there a couple of times, and we've had the privilege of trying out the Eagle pulpit and the S.D. Reed organ, and also praying our prayers of thanks for this rather fascinating and unique chapter of planting the church. The living quarters in the chapel car included a study with a desk and a bookshelf, a bedroom, usually of an upper and lower berth, though some had a double bed, a wardrobe and locker. The little kitchen had a stove, hot water, sink, sideboard, china cupboard, linen press, and lavatory. And the chapel included hardwood pews, 3 and 2 seating, 3 on one side of the aisle and 2 on the other, for about 100 people. Had a coat closet, a deacon's bench, a brass pulpit, a phonograph, a reed organ, almost always an SD, some connection there, a brass chandelier, hymnals, tract rack, stained glass window decorations above the larger windows, and windows that could be opened for fresh air. And now Matt's going to help us with the amazing technology, and you're going to actually see the inside of Chapel Car Grace. A very brief video clip, but I think it's important for our time together. It goes at less than 3 minutes, but watch carefully.
Furnishings have now been collected by the West Virginia Historical Society and placed on display in its museum in Parchment Valley. The seventh chapel car, Grace, was donated by Mr. and Mrs. Cassaway of Los Angeles in honor of their daughter in May of 1915. It was the only car with an outer construction of steel rather than wood. It served in Nevada, California, Wyoming, and Utah. Grace remained in service for more than 30 years. Hakan Knudsen led a worship service in Chicago on April 23, 1946, while Grace was en route to retirement at Green Lake, Wisconsin. At the American Baptist Assembly, Grace stands as a symbol of the unique ministry of the 7 specially equipped railroad cars that crisscrossed the American West and South, bringing the gospel to settlements along the tracks. What was it like to worship and live in a chapel car? The cars comfortably accommodated about 100 people, seated 2 on one side and 3 on the other. Each car contained a pulpit, an organ, and a phonograph. A hot water system kept the car warm in winter, and an acetylene gas plant lighted it. A railway chapel required a railway parsonage with pantry, kitchen, dining room, study, parlor, and bedroom, all one and the same room. There lived the preacher, organist, soloist, cook, and janitor in the persons of the missionary and his wife. C.H. Rust wrote, "At first we found it rather hard to adjust ourselves to the size of our apartment. Everything seemed to be in the way, and we were always in each other's way. At the end of the first 3 months, we had numberless bruises because of running into sharp corners and things in general. The parsonage of the car could hardly be called a home. It was more of a business office for the Lord's busy missionaries. We had practically no privacy. We prayed for special grace and wisdom every day in our endeavor to fit into the demands of the place and the work. The surviving chapel cars remind us of the men and women who traveled the rails with the gospel, brought the church to thousands of people who had no other means of hearing the word. With Boston W. Smith, we might ask, who could doubt that the Lord's hand was in this movement?" In 1898, 7 years after the first chapel.
Thank you very much for getting this on and off at the right time. Much appreciated.
That voice sounded like Newt Gingrich.
Well, how did this work? Was it at all successful? You get the impression from the film that it was. Within 1 month after the first chapel car that we just dedicated a few minutes ago was inaugurated, thousands of circulars were printed with a picture of the car and the intent of Evangel's ministry. This is a direct quote. "Would the car be of service in your town or neighborhood? Write Evangel, Minneapolis, Minnesota," end quote. Within 1 month, enough requests had arrived to book the car 2 meetings each weekday and 5 to 7 each Sunday for 2 years. There are limited, very limited records, really authentic records of the ministry, especially the 3 Episcopal and the 3 Roman Catholic cars. The Baptist records are a bit better. For example, hard data, 1905, the chapel car ministries reported of the American Baptist Church that they had established 135 new churches, 112 mission starts, or meeting houses. They had established 243 Bible schools and 4,578 baptisms were recorded. 6 languages were used: French, German, Swedish, Danish, Norwegian, and English. As the costs increased, the railroads were less and less apt to provide free passage for the chapel cars. And costs rose to 54 cents per mile right after World War II. And that and much more, the renewed production of the automobile put an end to the chapel car ministry at the end of World War II. Another evangelistic effort, advertised as interdenominational and nonpartisan for the railroad workers, was the Railroad Evangelistic Association. It held evangelistic meetings, Bible camps, and produced literature, including a monthly publication that lasted over 40 years. The publication was called The Railroad Evangelist. I wish I had some copies with me. I have some on file at home. Its theme on every cover, the two safest ways to travel, the Bible way and the railroad way. And that's still true. There's no form of moving passengers that's safer than the railroad. Automobiles are far down the list as far as safest. Well, let's take a quick look at social ministry and gifts to churches, and then we'll talk about the preachers. As railroads became more common, they ushered in rapid change and an awareness of some of life's challenges. Mobility increased. Social ills became more common, or at least more noticeable. And the railroads responded in at least four ways. First of all, a number of orphanages were built and operated by railroads. Others were encouraged to be built, or in part were responded to in the way of building with other organizations. Second, travelers' aid societies were set up to help travelers, many arriving from overseas with no English language. And no doubt some of our foreparents were assisted by these societies and large railroad terminals in all metropolitan areas. They assisted with counseling and often helped with food, cheap lodging, transportation, job possibilities, and making some sense out of the complicated railroad timetables. A third way was rebuilding after the Civil War. The railroads played an indispensable role in the Civil War. They also helped both the South and the North to reconstruct their economies and ways of life after the war stopped. By the way, one could argue for other possible outcomes of the war between the states had the South rather than the North had the better railroads. It was that close. Tipping in terms of winning that particular battle. Adoptions would be number four. The results of rapid transportation and urbanization were not all positive. Disease, war, abandonment of children resulted. And from the 1850s, the railroads developed a service of linking orphans from the urban East with adoptive parents in the West, especially in Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, but also as far as Kansas and Nebraska. It's very rare that we make this presentation, but that somebody in the room has had a contact with some part of a family that was part of this adoptive process. This and other efforts in social ministry were not always successful. The motives were not always pure. The efforts sometimes were crude. Sometimes the orphan trains simply provided cheap labor. But on the other hand, a large number of good homes were found for orphaned and abandoned children. When I was at Holden a few years ago, I gave an earlier version of this talk at Holden, and Diane Shiner commented that she knew that the railroads helped to bring brides to the men who were taming the West. And she knew of some stories in Butte, Montana, for instance, where that had happened. But I don't know of any organized efforts for that at this point. There may have been some. Third would be gifts to churches and colleges. Some railroads received land grants from the federal government. The largest land grant subsidy that I know of was the Winona and St. Peter Railroad in Minnesota that received 1.6 million acres of land. Those two cities are not that far apart. 8% of railroads were built on these gifts that totaled 131 million acres, worth $126 million at the time. You may think this is not totally fair, but I would rather call these payments than subsidies. Listen to the story and see if you might not agree. The government was paying or subsidizing the railroad to tie the nation together. And as we have learned over the years, usually when Uncle Sam giveth, Uncle Sam taketh, right? Well, in this case, the United States government received a 50 to 100% discount in moving all government goods and people, including World War I and World War II. And at the end of World War II, the railroads came to the Congress and said, enough already. And there was a study, and the accounting showed that for the $126 million investment in land given to, or the subsidized land given to the railroads, the U.S. government had received services in excess of $900 million. $126 million invested, $900 million profit. Not too bad. Maybe we should do more of that. I don't know. Some of the land was given to churches. In fact, a fair amount was. For example, the former Augustana Lutheran churches, Swedish background, now part of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, along the Great Northern Main Line through Cokato, Dassel, Litchfield, Kandiohi, Wilmer, Benson, Minnesota, virtually all benefited directly or indirectly with land or other gifts. James J. Hill, the empire builder, the founder of the Great Northern Railway, especially liked Swedes, believing that they were honest, trustworthy, moral, good workers. Now, my Norsky spouse thinks that the Swedes conned the poor guy. But the point was that railroads were very generous in many parts of the country and sometimes gave stained glass windows, reed or pipe organs to churches. They also gave communities their first libraries in a number of places. And it made good sense. This was good business. It brought people into the communities, and more people meant more business and hence more profit. Gifts to churches encouraged the morality and stability, countered the unseemly elements, and perhaps most important, silenced the opposition. We'll get to that in a minute. But first, a little aside about the colleges. Augustana College, Rock Island, Illinois, was built totally or partly on land given by the railroad. James J. Hill was convinced that St. Olaf College should have an endowment. And when the trustees and president said, that would mean we don't trust God, we don't need to have an endowment, he pressed harder and came to the president pledging $50,000 on the condition that St. Olaf College would raise $200,000 for the establishment of an endowment by January of 1913. There were some complications and delays, tough times in 1911, but when Kildall became president in 1912, he negotiated an extension for the Great Northern Match for 1 year. And 3 months ahead of the deadline, Kildall, the president, reported that $151,489.69 had been raised in cash and $336,000 in pledges. So the Great Northern Railway gift was among the first gifts to build the St. Olaf College Endowment Fund. And I just learned today from our good friend from Valparaiso University that if the Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan, whose name was Stevenson, had not killed his girlfriend on the train between Fort Wayne and Gary, Indiana in 1925, and had not thrown her body off the train, and had not gotten caught and thrown in jail, Valparaiso University may well have been Ku Klux Klan University. Because Stevenson, as I understand it, had arranged financing to buy this pretty much bankrupt school at that time. Now that's a rather thin connection with the railroad, but I told you this wasn't all going to be terribly serious, but it's a fascinating story. Preachers and railroads. Church opposition to the railroads was intense. It was fierce in early years. And I'm going to give you just two examples of how the railroads threatened to divide the church. There are many more, but two. The first is the churches were pro-canal. And when a large series of canals were built in many communities to connect the major eastern cities, that was fine. Water comes down from heaven, waters the earth, falling freely on the just and unjust alike. It's a gift from God. But when the railroads came, compare that with the biblical pastoral scene of the water and the green, fire, smoke, steam, cinders, noise of Satan's new curse, which is the label the churches gave to the steam engine. In some communities, the church did divide over this issue. So, don't think that church threats of division are new at all. There aren't. You think there are threats today, let me tell you one bigger than call to common mission or the possibility of gay, lesbian persons serving in ordained ministry, controversies in our church today. Doesn't hold a candle. Doesn't hold a candle to setting the clock. Every community up until the early 1870s could decide whatever time it was. So every community would decide when 12 noon was, and the railroads came to Congress and said, this doesn't make any sense. We need time zones where all the clocks are the same in a certain geographical area. You see, it would be like leaving Seattle at noon and arriving in Edmonds at 11 at night, and then getting to Everett at 9 in the morning, and Wenatchee at 2 o'clock yesterday afternoon. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but you get the point. It made absolutely no sense. But according to some preachers, it was causing the sin of tampering with God's time. It threatened, as few things have, to divide the church. A Reverend Watson in Tennessee drove the point home very substantially in a sermon as he finished a fire and brimstone tirade against the railroad with his quote, "They'll never tamper with God's time in this church." And as he concluded, "in this church," he put his pocket watch on the pulpit and smashed with a hammer. But the time zones were adopted. And it's still a problem, or at least an annoyance, for some of our fundamentalistic Christian friends in the Bible Belt. There are still areas in the country that don't want to be a part of that time zone or change to daylight time or whatever. Well, another thing probably didn't threaten the church's existence or to divide the church, but I find this to be just a really funny, fascinating, true story. how trains were permitted to run on Sunday is just an amazing story. I'm going to take you very quickly through about six steps. First of all, no trains ran at all from 6 p.m. on Saturday until Monday morning. That was just the Lord's day, and that's the way it was. Well, that created some problems, so there were negotiations that went on, and then the second step was that no train ran on Sunday morning. But that also became problematic because the trains would end up at weird places on Saturday night, and they wanted to go a little further, so then the third step was on Sunday mornings, all passenger trains were ordered to stop for worship. But then that became problematic because the churches in the towns where the train stopped squabbled over where the people were going to come to worship, and there was a lot of controversy and jealousy in the whole congregation. So that didn't work out very well. So the fourth thing was on Sunday mornings, the conductor, or his, and it was always a his, never a her, designee, would walk up and down the length of the train reading scripture. True story. Number five was that money and other gifts were given to churches. Now, a part of that was generous, but a part of it maybe was trying to buy them off a little bit. And the sixth point that worked quite well, clergy rates were offered to all clergy. Now, in fairness, I think we also should admit that there were still some people in the railroad industry very interested in planning the church. And I think probably we could come up with a list of people that went out by train and went out to far places after the chapel cars were no more to do the Sunday service. But I think it was also there to silence the opposition of the churches, and it worked quite well. The half-price railroad tickets available to all pastors from a railroad financed bureau in Chicago Union Station continued until 1973, 30 years ago, 2 years after Amtrak was organized. Well, we want to stop and have a little time for conversation, but I want to thank you for coming tonight and giving up what otherwise would have been a very nice night outside or someplace else. And I hope this gives you a little glimpse of how the church was planted and supported by the railroads. And maybe, just maybe, your appreciation of the railroads, long at the bottom of our transportation priorities as a nation, has increased a little bit. For me, in closing, I find trains to be a fascinating hobby, sensitive to an ecologically sound way to move goods and people. I enjoy riding trains any place, any time. And unless there is a development of a new technology, I believe they hold enormous potential, at least, for achieving the level of the French TGVs that are the world's best trains. They now travel between most major European cities at speeds up to 187 miles an hour. And translating that into our own context, that would be Seattle to Portland in 1 hour, or Seattle to Vancouver, BC in 1 hour, including stopping at the border, or 2.5 from Minneapolis, St. Paul to Chicago. So, what questions or what can you add to the story? Almost always there's a new insight that comes, including my conversation today with Fred Niedner.
Well, there's a link to Holden and Railroad Creek.
Railroad Creek, yeah.
Here we are because of some of the first work done in this valley was by the Great Northern Railroad.
That's right.
And
engineering.
One of the reasons why the minerals were found is because this rock was so hard.
Yeah. And I think we can all tell why they didn't choose to lay their tracks through here. But that was thought to be one of the lines that you could go through the Cascades.
Did you shed a tear when they shifted from steam to diesel?
I remember the steam engines, and I ride behind steam every year, almost 1,500 miles behind steam, but it's harder and harder to do that. That was in China. The steam locomotive, I would argue strenuously, is the most human of all inventions, not the computer.
I thought it was a can opener.
The steam locomotive breathes, wheezes, coughs, spits, needs to be coaxed, just like people. Little nostalgia there. There is still some research being done on steam-powered engines, including trains. I mean, very, very super efficient steam.
To avoid coal.
Well, they could use coal or oil. See, railroads can use steam, coal, oil, electricity. I suppose they could even do nuclear. Wind is a little tricky. Wind-powered, solar-generated electricity. Solar. There are some solar switches and signals on our railroads today. Yeah.
You made some reference to a possible connection about ESTE organs. Can you say more about that?
All I know is that ESTE was one of the people very much interested in the chapel car ministry. So I'm assuming, but I don't know this, that they probably even gave their instruments to the chapel cars, and some of them are really quite nice.
Made in Brattleboro, Vermont.
Yep. I didn't find any I don't know of any two manual ESTE organs, but I know they also made some very grand instruments and were put out of business basically by Hammond in the late 1930s. Sad story.
Did you ever work on the railroad?
No, then it wouldn't be any fun.
Why are the, I'm sorry.
You would, go ahead. I take the train every time I come out to Holden, and I really enjoy it because I go alone, and I go in and I sit down for dinner, and they always seat somebody with you. So
yes.
I've had some of the most neatest conversations with different people. And one time, I went out to Seattle to visit my daughter, and we were, I don't know, almost 12 hours late. But what happened, there was a lot of snow and the train had to back up and go forward. A lot of trouble. But what just blew my mind was I ate the last supper, and all of a sudden the people I was sitting with, and they said, "We're not moving." And we couldn't figure out why we weren't moving. So we asked the waiter or the waitress, and he said, the engineer shift quit.
Yep.
So we had to sit there for 3 hours and wait for another engineer to come. And I said, well, thank goodness I rode the train, because if it had been the airplane.
Lots of redundant safety features. One is that the crew can only be active so long, and then they stop no matter where they are.
And that's good too, because they don't get sleepy.
I was going to ask, why are the tracks in such bad shape in some places, though?
Well, this gets to be very complicated, and it all comes down to funding. Every other form of transportation gets a lot of federal money.
But you know, they talk about new technologies of anti-magnetic, suspension. So you're traveling on a magnetic field.
Yeah. That's possible. They've done it in Germany, but it's very expensive.
It's not a priority in this country.
It's very low. Our president wants to shut down Amtrak, and almost did it last year. Funding somehow got through Congress, and it's funded through October 1st of this year. Anybody's guess after that. So if you want to ride Amtrak, do it soon.
I think he could give a tracks cut.
I'm a little slow. I missed that. That was good, Rich. That was good. Time for a couple more comments, and then we must go over and practice so we can sing for worship tonight. I'm sure somebody heard us and will ask us to do that.
Some people out east in Washington don't know how many people live in North Dakota and
want to
go somewhere.
Oh, I know it, because that's a long way.
Well, it bothers me every time I see a pleasure boat go through Red Wing, Minnesota, where I live, knowing that when they go through the locks, what is it, 20,000 pleasure boats a year, something like that, go through the locks? That's your tax money that allows those boats to go through the locks. I think there is maybe a little user fee now, but it's basically all tax dollars. All the dredging is tax money. All the pipelines, 100% tax subsidized. So it's kind of a crazy mixed up mess that we have. There is a little federal money that goes into the railroads and especially into Amtrak, but it's just a tiny little pittance. And that's been dropping. Highway has gone up, and airlines, of course, have gone just sky high, especially after 9/11.
Have you, along with trains, streetcars are another track type of thing.
Light rail.
And there was, several years ago, I recorded off of PBS, I think, and it talked about how big corporations like General Motors or GE that have had interest in having
light rail,
electrified things. They more or less advise company or town or cities to take up their tracks, so
oh, yeah.
they could sell buses that
oh, yeah.
operated on gasoline or diesel.
General Motors, Firestone, and I have to get this right now. Who was the other one? Southern Pacific Railroad were found guilty in court in 1939 for dismantling the basically dismantling the light rail system in Los Angeles, and were fined. These big corporations found guilty, $5,000 apiece.
Wow.
So the stakes have been against the railroads for a long time in this country. Thanks much for coming. We can continue our conversation.